You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We have, as ever, a great show for you today featuring three fantastic Brighton writers, Lauren Bravo, Andrew Flewitt and Emma-Jane Hunsworth. Lauren talks about her wonderful new book, Probably Fine, which has such a fascinating premise. What would happen if you got a call to say your very casual lover had died suddenly and he'd told his family that you were the one? Andrew Flewitt's moving anthology is made up of nine interviews with members of the Andrew Flewitt's moving anthology, Do You Believe in Life After Loss, is made up of nine interviews with members of the queer community to speak about loss in its myriad forms of identity, relationships, death, work and more. I also speak to my mate and friend of the show, Emma-Jane Hunsworth, about her amazing new book, Slags, which I think might actually be her best yet, which is saying something because I couldn't love Emma's writing anymore if I tried. It follows 40-year-old something, Sarah, on a road trip to Scotland with her sister, trying to make sense of her past, untangling her sibling relationship and getting into all sorts of whiskey-fueled trouble. Phil Viner also joins us to talk about Beyond the Book Festival, which is happening on May the 10th in Brighton. Links to everything we've spoken about can be found via our Instagram page at BTM Book Club. You can subscribe to the podcast and if you're feeling generous, give us a nice rating. Enjoy the show and tell your book-loving friends. Bryony doesn't actually mind being single. So she doesn't understand why she keeps seeing, okay, sleeping with Ed, who is perfectly fine, but also only okay. After developing the ick on their fifth date, she resolves to end things, only to receive a call the next day telling her Ed has died. Worse yet, he seems to have represented her to his family and friends as his great love. Obviously, it would be cruel to correct them. Then she's invited to the funeral. It would be equally rude to refuse, right? Before she knows it, Bryony has been drawn in by the charisma and chaos of Ed's eccentric family and tangled in a web of her own lies. She's been guilted into signing up to his sister's pyramid scheme, she's in far too deep with several of his nearest and dearest, and to make matters worse, she's experiencing a lot of physical symptoms that are becoming harder and harder to ignore. Probably Nothing is the answer to just how far sheer awkwardness can take someone. Peppered with Lauren Bravo's irresistible wit, it explores the relatable modern cults of wellness and people-pleasing and digs into the eternal dilemma, life is short, so should you settle for perfectly fine? Lauren Bravo, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you for having me. It's very weird listening to my own blurb being read back to me. I didn't write that myself, by the way. Irresistible wit, I wouldn't say that.
Well, I definitely would. And I loved Probably Nothing. I really, really raced through it. And I love this really bold, high concept, central premise. When did the idea come to you?
So I'd actually had the idea a long, long time ago, probably more than 10 years ago. And originally it was going to be somebody having a one night stand and then waking up next to that person to find that they had died. But I thought that was actually going to get a bit tricky because then I would have to get into, you know, are they incriminated? How do we deal with like the police procedurals? Like, how would that go? And I don't love doing research. So I thought, okay, let's make it easier. But I'd had that idea just kind of percolating in the back of my head for ages. And I love comedy that's fueled by awkwardness and British politeness, you know, and that question of just how far will we go to avoid kind of seeming a bit rude. And I thought it was just such an irresistible kind of setup for a comedy. So, yeah, I was delighted when I sort of finally had a chance to sit down and flesh it out and see where it went.
Bryony is a serial people pleaser. And I know you've written about being a people pleaser or a recovering people pleaser. Was it important to you that you kind of got that in there?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, therapy is really expensive, whereas writing books sometimes feels cheaper and easier. So I knew that I wanted to sort of work through a lot of those issues in the book. And I just thought it was really relatable. And, you know, my immediate question, I suppose, was, well, why would somebody go through with pretending that they had been in love with somebody, going to their funeral, becoming embroiled in their kind of family events? And why would they go that far? And people pleasing just seemed like the obvious answer. I think there are two types of people. There are people that read Bryony's story and think, well, she's clearly insane and needs some help. And then there are people that read Bryony's story and go, yeah, that's exactly what you have to do. What other option did she have? And those are my people. So recovering is definitely the term. I wouldn't say I'm recovered, but I think writing the book was quite helpful in sort of showing me, shining a light on some of my own behaviours. And I think making me realise that people pleasing is not always necessarily driven by being really altruistic. Like, actually, there's quite a lot of I don't know, it can be quite sort of selfish in its motivation sometimes. You have this need for everybody to love you all the time, and often, as Bryony kind of learns through her journey in the book, you know, it can actually be kinder to people to tell them the truth than to Absolutely. Tell them what you think they want to hear.
Definitely. I love that. And I loved Bryony's relationship with her housemate and her best friend. And for me, we were just talking before I hit record about categorizing books and how often people think that your books are rom-coms and might be disappointed when they're not straightforward rom-coms. But for me, the friendship in this book was really romantic. How do you feel about kind of categorization as an author?
Thank you. Yeah, I find it really tricky because I write books that are often shelved with rom-coms and, you know, categorized as romances, and I love romances, but romance readers tend to like their books to follow a very specific formula, and they need to know that there's going to be a waltzing off into the sunset at the end because that's what you're in it for. And I agree with you. I think there can be an awful lot of romance, kind of, you know, lowercase r romance, if you like, in friendships, in community, in found family, in, you know, all of the other relationships that we have in our lives that aren't necessarily that central capital R romantic relationship. And so that's kind of what I like to write. Like, my last novel, Pre-Loved, again, was not a romance, but I think was filled with romance and had lots of little kind of love stories throughout it. And it's subtitled with a love story about things. So there's a lot of romance tied up in the objects that were in the book as well. So yeah, I'm really interested in kind of books that defy categorization, I think, in that way, and do sort of straddle the genres a little bit, or maybe sit in their own kind of categories. And that doesn't always make them the easiest to sell, but hopefully it does make them a little bit surprising and interesting to read.
I would love to hear an extract. Can you read us some, please?
Yeah, okay. So this is from chapter 4, so we're early on in the book. Bryony has just received a phone call to tell her that the man she's been casually sleeping with, Ed, has died. And she received the phone call while she was waiting in line at a very popular no bookings restaurant, and therefore had to go through the kind of internal dilemma of whether or not she should leave the queue. Because, you know, she'd already been waiting 25 minutes and she was hungry. Okay, so she's having dinner with her friend Noemi. "You were not into him though, were you?" shrugged Noemi, chewing on an olive stone. So far, there had been minimal hand-patting. "You do not seem sad." Bryony, who had drama A-level, felt mildly insulted. "I mean, I suppose I'm in shock? I must be," she told her. "It's terrible, terrible news." Noemi frowned. Bryony added a third for good measure. "Terrible? You have never even mentioned this, Ed. I never saw him on your socials." "Well," she paused and scooped up a dollop of garlicky yogurt. Her earlier wooziness was beginning to subside now she was eating. "We were low-key." "So it was just sex?" "No, no." "So you actually liked him?" "Sure, sure." Bryony shoved a comfy potato into her mouth whole. Noemi watched her chew, one eyebrow arched in Gallic incredulity. "Well, it's a moot point now," she said once he'd eventually swallowed. "He's dead." Back at home, Bryony tried to cry. She whimpered, screwing her eyes up tight and gurning in approximation of heartbreak. Nothing. She relaxed her facial muscles, let her mouth hang open, willing her tear ducts to fill and spill elegantly down her cheeks. She faced herself in the mirror and affected a shudder, letting out great big noisy gulps of grief. But after a few minutes of this, all that happened was that she'd swallowed so much air she belched. It tasted of garlic. Bryony was usually a slutty crier. She cried at adverts and at radio dedications, at nostalgic playlists and elderly men fumbling for change in the supermarket. She cried any time she thought about the 2012 Olympics. She regularly cried reading about the deaths of strangers on the internet, their ages inversely proportional to the volume of her sobs. But not now. For Ed, perfectly pleasant Ed, who had made her calm and made her a cup of tea afterwards, she couldn't muster so much as one tear. Perhaps if she put on a song that reminded her of him. But the only songs that reminded her of Ed were I Am the Walrus, because her flatmate Marco used to call him the Eggman, and Freed from Desire, because it had been playing on Kiss FM during one of their taxi rides home, and he had sung along, believing the lyrics to be He's Got His Trombone Knees. If she played that now, would it be moving or deranged? She opened her phone and read their last message exchange. Ed, that was fun, winky face. Bryony, yes, great times. Ed, get home safe, kiss. Bryony, will do, kiss. Ed, an hour later, did you by any chance take my AirPods by mistake? Bryony, no, soz, didn't see them. Ed, oh, okay, no worries, must have left them somewhere. Bryony, thumbs up emoji. This achieved nothing except to make a small and sinister part of her wish that she had, in fact, taken his AirPods. She scrolled back further through weeks of stilted contact, telling herself, he is dead. He is dead now. He cannot do it again sometime, kiss, because he is dead. After a while, she gave up, reached for her laptop instead, and Googled anaphylaxis. She scrolled and clicked for 20 minutes, taking in the same information, phrased slightly differently each time, via the NHS and WebMD and Healthline.com and the Cleveland Clinic. Why did the Cleveland Clinic always rank so highly? What was happening in Cleveland that gave them such SEO clout? As a rule, Bryony trusted the NHS most implicitly, but preferred the American pages for colour, drama and lurid detail. She Googled, can you become allergic wasps later life? The answers were inconclusive, but erred towards yes. She read about venom immunotherapy and Googled, can you have immunotherapy as precaution? This mainly returned results about cancer treatment, so she spent a further 20 minutes reading about cancer. Bryony had been like this for decades. Every flu-like symptom had been suspected toxic shock syndrome since the first time she read the leaflet in a tampon box. Visits to the doctor invariably brought normal test results and all the usual questions about whether she ate breakfast or whether she might be stressed at work. Was she sleeping well, drinking enough water? Bryony always drank enough water, chugging back gallons of it from a series of increasingly high-tech vessels. Her urine was nearly always colourless, like the palest vino verde, and of this she was inordinately proud. Eventually, she heard Marco come home. She walked into the kitchen to find him wearing his scrubs with a knitted tank top over them, whistling to himself while putting potato waffles in the toaster. The Eggman is dead, she told him. What? Seriously? Wasp sting. This morning, he was allergic. And now he's dead. Oh my God. I know. How old was he? 33, she told him. The same as Jesus. And just like that, Marco began to cry.
That was so beautifully read. And it was so great to go back into Bryony's world. I love her voice so much. And I think that's really where your books are so strong. Your voice is absolutely wonderful. So obviously there is a death at the heart of this kind of this comedy, in a slightly farcical comedy. But, you know, so it's very funny, but also, you know, got really, really big sadness at its heart and tackles some difficult subjects, not just Ed dying, but both Bryony and Kelly, whose voices the story is told in, lost their mums when they were young, which has led them to respond in really different ways as adults. And as someone that also lost my mum when I was really young, I was really touched by this. Why was it important to you to cover this?
Oh, well, thank you so much. I think as a writer, it's always one of my greatest sources of fear is tackling things that I haven't necessarily directly experienced myself. And so, yeah, it's you know, really meaningful when somebody tells me that it resonated with them. I think that grief and humour are kind of natural bedfellows in a way. And it's a funny one. I'm often asked, like, oh, why did you write a book about grief and make it so funny? And I always think it would have been harder not to, because in a weird way, you know, we deal with life's kind of biggest hardships, grief and personal tragedy, you know, with humour a lot of the time. I think we're often looking to let the light into the darkness in any way we can. So I always start off kind of with a slightly ridiculous premise or something that feels maybe quite light and fluffy. And then without even really intending to, I end up tapping into quite a lot of darkness along the way. And maybe it's partly just sort of balancing out, you know, a book. You want a book to kind of have light and shade. You want parts to feel really light and entertaining and other parts to feel quite meaty and satisfying. But also I think that idea of being welcomed into somebody else's family and looking for family when you're perhaps missing parts of it yourself is something that I've always found fascinating. And, you know, I'm very lucky it's not something I have direct experience of. My kind of immediate family are all, you know, well and alive, I'm very grateful to say. But I love, love, love books that are about outsiders coming into these kind of big eccentric families and trying to belong and finding often that they don't necessarily. There's a great kind of literary line of books like, you know, Brideshead Revisited and The Pursuit of Love and Brother of the More Famous Jack is one of my favourites, that are all about these kind of slightly madcap families often living in these kind of crumbling castles and often a sort of slightly lonely outsider who comes into their midst and finds themselves sort of, you know, intoxicated by the family and their lore and their chaos. And I love books like that. So this was kind of my tribute to those kind of books. So it sort of made sense for me, I think, that Bryony would be looking for something. And that would be another reason besides beyond people pleasing that she would get kind of drawn into Ed's family and sort of outstay her welcome, as it were. And then I like the idea of Bryony and Kelly, who are very different characters on the surface, but sort of finding that bond through having both lost a mum and then this kind of matriarch Anne, who is very much at the centre of their world, being this person that they're both in different ways sort of determined to please. So yeah, grief kind of just ended up coming into it a lot more than I expected that it would. But I'm really pleased to hear kind of from people who do have more firsthand experience that I tackled it in a way that felt real.
Absolutely. So Lauren, you are a writer in Brighton. You actually grew up in Brighton and have since moved back. What's it like to be a writer here?
Well, I have to be honest, Anna, because I actually grew up in Worthing, which, as you know, we all know, you can get away with saying you grew up in Brighton until you meet someone who actually did grow up in Brighton. And then they say, oh, whereabouts? And then you say Worthing. And then it's very embarrassing for everybody. But when I grew up, Brighton was very much the promised land. And I went to sixth form, I went to Basvic in Brighton. I was, you know, just delighted to be on that 7:30 train every morning, kind of heading towards what I thought was the coolest city in the world. And I still think it is in many ways. So I moved to London when I was 18 and I lived there for 18 years. And then I moved back to Brighton last summer. And I'm so delighted to be back. And it feels like such a brilliant kind of creative community down here. I knew it would. I knew that there were loads of authors that I loved that were based in Brighton. And yeah, it's really lovely kind of knowing that you've got lots of other creative people kind of on your doorstep and lovely independent bookshops as well that have been really, really supportive of my stuff. And it's just great. I mean, you know, knowing that the sea is right there. I can't say I get in the sea that often, but it's there and that's important as well.
Lauren, how can we find and follow you?
I am at Lauren Bravo on every platform because I have a weird name, so no one else ever needs my handle. And I have a Substack called Nobody Wanted This, which is where I write stuff that I've pitched and had rejected. And yeah, most good bookshops have my books, so I'd love people to discover them.
Probably Nothing is out now in paperback with Simon & Schuster and available from all good retailers. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I am joined by Brighton-based writer Andrew Flewitt, whose new anthology, Do You Believe in Life After Loss, is out very soon with Jessica Kingsley Publishers on the 21st of May 2025. This is a collection of queer experiences of loss, hope and resilience, and it explores different aspects of loss, the challenges of these situations, and also talks about how queerness might help people to navigate change and loss and the opportunities and hope that can arise when healing begins. Exploring experiences of loss in all its forms, from bereavement and relationship breakups to loss of community, safety and identity, this book considers how queerness might help people to navigate change and loss and asks the question, do you believe in life after loss? Curated by Andrew Flewitt and with contributions from psychotherapist Silver Neves throughout, the book features interviews with Nathaniel J. Hall, Zachary Tucker, Juno Roche, Vineet Mehta, Mendez and many others. I'm delighted to be joined by Andrew to talk about this anthology. Andrew, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much, Anna, for having me. That's such a lovely intro. I was sitting here smiling as you're reading all that out. It's doesn't really feel real. So this is lovely. So thank you so much for
It's my pleasure. You did this. Your book, baby, is real.
that.
How do you feel?
Do you know what? I feel really, really proud. I had a bit of a telling off a few weeks ago from Juno. I interviewed her as part of the podcast, and I was saying, I just feel really grateful and really lucky. And she said, "Luck has nothing to do about with this. This is your work, and I want you to really take this moment in and really enjoy this experience." And it was, I think, it comes back down to that. We become a bit kind of we want to be proud, but sometimes we're a bit like we don't want to be too proud. It's a very British thing, isn't it? And I think the experience of writing it was so amazing. And now this is the nice part. It's the well, the writing was the nice part, but this is the other part where I get to talk about it and promote it and actually meet people that want to read it or have read it. And it's a bit mind-blowing. It's like, wow, this is really happening. So I feel very excited, very proud. But yeah, just yeah, it's unbelievable, really. But it's amazing.
And this is a really, really beautiful anthology. And I think it's also important to remember that, publishing isn't a charity. They're not publishing this to please you. They're publishing this because they think people want to and should read it. And I completely agree with them. What decided to
Oh, thank
make
you.
you curate this anthology? Do you remember the moment when you were like, this is the book we need?
Yeah, so I mean, it came from a lot of personal kind of pain and upheaval, really, in my life. In early 2023, so I lost my dad. My dad passed away in January 2023, and then I had to make a very difficult decision to walk away from some of the members of my family. We all have different things we have to deal with in life, but that was just one of those decisions that I needed to make at what was already a very, very difficult time. So there was loss there as well. And I think what I've come to realize about that situation is that even if you make a decision like that, it's not taken lightly. And also, it's still a loss. You're grieving what would have been or what you thought you had and all these different scenarios. So there was a lot kind of going on there. And then a few months later, my husband and I separated for 9 months. So in the space of about 5 months, every kind of thing that I had known or the family dynamic that I'd had created for such a long time kind of came to an end. And I found myself very much kind of alone with my thoughts and just thinking about, okay, well, what happens next? And I remember I went out one evening and I think I woke up the next morning and I started thinking about, the struggle of loss and how difficult it can be and what happens when we lose, what decisions do we have to make and what options do we have? And it was kind of that sink or swim situation. It was like, okay, I've lost quite a lot already this year. What next? And how do I deal with this? And then the title, Do You Believe in Life After Loss, popped in my head. Now, I don't know if that's because I was in the pub the night before and the Cher anthem was playing on loop or something and it was in my head. I'm not sure. But it just suddenly made me think, what happens after loss? Is there life after loss? And how do we rebuild ourselves and move forward with life? I took myself on a trip for 3 months. I had a sabbatical from work. I went to Gran Canaria and lived in the north of the island and just kind of really was by myself with my thoughts, nowhere to run, just very much kind of there processing the losses that had occurred that year. And then I started to write. And initially, I started writing my own story. So I write down lots about the dynamics that had led to the changes and, different things I needed to kind of express personally to kind of get out. And that's in the draft pile. That isn't the kind of book that's been released today. But when I started speaking to the publisher, they're very much like, there's something here, but actually, there's lots of loss. You've already had three different types of loss here, but actually there's lots of different losses and lots of different losses in the queer community as well. How can we bring other types of losses into this narrative and into the discussion? So I almost didn't do it. This is the thing. I was away and I felt a little bit exhausted. And I was like, I don't know if I have the energy to do this. And then about a week before I was due to come back to Brighton, I was like, I'm just going to have a little look at this and see if I could put a proposal together and see what they're saying to me, if I can come up with an idea and think about what this might look like. And yeah, so I did. And I spoke to a friend who is part of the book, my friend Ewan, and we talked about his experience with loss. And I said, look, if I write the intro and a proposal, can I interview you and then can we submit this? And we did. And then 2 months later, I got the book deal. So it almost didn't happen. So it's a little bit kind of crazy to think that now. But then, I started thinking about the different types of losses. You know, loss isn't exclusive to death, as painful as that can be. You know, loss can touch us in very different ways in life, and we all have very different experiences, as the book kind of illustrates. So it was then a case of going out there and trying to utilize a platform I'd created with my podcast, Queer I Am, to make connections and see if people would be interested. And then, you know, put word out there on socials and see if people wanted to come forward and have discussions. And I was lucky that I got 9 incredible interviews. And one of them is my husband as well. So we have a chapter called Loss of a Partner. And we talk very frankly about our separation. And, you know, we're very lucky we decided to have another go and move forward. And, you know, life is in a very different place now. But we talk about that experience and don't shy away from it, because it's a reality of life. It's something that happens to a lot of people. But sometimes it's just too painful to kind of talk about, or you kind of move on very quickly. And I think that was a very healing experience as well, to be able to talk about that quite openly and move forward. So yeah, that's probably answered your question in a very long way, but it's
right.
It was incredible experience.
It's really great to hear about it. And actually, you answered quite a few of my questions in there. And and I really like, actually, I find it really refreshing how it covers many different forms of loss, I think, because, you know, life is nothing if we don't lose anything, right? I was wondering if there were kind of little gems of knowledge or things that people said when you were interviewing them for the anthology that really stuck with you.
Do you know, there's one, excuse me, there's one that really sticks with me, and I've thought about it so much. And I have to say, all of the interviews, you know I wrote this and interviewed these people, but I just think they're incredible because they're all so different. And I think wherever you are in your journey with loss, whatever you're going through, even if you can't directly relate to the experience that someone's talking about, you will take something from it, because it's about, for me, I think what it is about that fundamental human connection. It's about how we connect with other people, how we lose, how we grieve, how we feel emotion. And, you know, when we connect on that type of level, I think you can lean into other people's experiences. So that's what I would say for first and foremost. I think all of the interviews are so different and so amazing. There is one line that Juno Roach says in the interview, and she just said, "I had to believe that there was life on the other side of the wall." And that just stuck with me. It was so simple, but just so profound. And I remember coming off the call from her interview and just thinking, oh my goodness, like, all of this wisdom and life experience and incredible knowledge this person has. And the interview itself is, you know, phenomenal. It's such an amazing interview. But those words, just like, after everything I went through, I had to believe there was life on the other side of the wall, you know. And it's like, deep down, we all feel that, you know, we all want to believe there's something that's going to come out of loss, or that we're going to be able to move forward with life. And it's really difficult to imagine that sometimes when you're in the midst of grief and you're going through a really difficult time. But that simple statement just kind of said it all to me. It was like, wow, we have to find that belief. We have to really think that we can get through it, to get through, to survive, to keep going and to keep moving forward, you know. So yeah, that's just one of the many things that she said. But, you know, everyone in the book said so many incredible and great things, but that one sentence was just very powerful for me.
Yeah, Juno's interview really stood out for me. I find there's such a mix of light and shade in the way that they talk, and it just makes you kind of feel really hopeful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Andrew, if anyone's listening and thinking, I've had no loss, I can't deal with my loss, or, you know, this is too much, why should they read this book? What would this book do for them?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that I've come to learn in my life is, and through our experience of having loss, is that we don't really prepare ourselves for it, and we don't, you know, I'm not suggesting that we all need to kind of like keep thinking about loss all the time so we're ready. But I think that it's a very normal thing to kind of step away from that conversation. It's very uncomfortable for people sometimes. And I think that when you are a person that has lost, sometimes you really want to talk about it. You know, I've been in situations before where I felt loss and I could feel that the people I'm talking to don't really want to talk about it because they're either uncomfortable or they're a little bit bored of me talking about it. You know, I remember in my 20s losing someone and just thinking, well, no one really cares anymore. Like, this is done. It's been a few months. I should be over this. So you almost feel like a burden. And I think that, you know, when you are going through that and you're having a difficult time, you need people around you. You need people to support you and also just to listen. So, but also I think we also need to, you know, prepare ourselves for the inevitable. You know, loss happens in life. We lose people. If we love, we lose. You know, that's the reality. And it's the kind of, you know, it's the spoiler, isn't it? It's like nothing lasts forever. And that may sound really bleak, but actually I think there's a real power in knowing that and owning that, because what you then do is you appreciate hopefully the moments that you do have and your life in a more of a, it could be in a more beautiful way. You know, it's rather than, you know, fearing something, you can really kind of take in what's kind of going on in life and really enjoy the experience of it. But also I would say that, you know, some of these stories, like for example, one of them that really sticks out in this question is, you know, Luciana Cousin, who's a local businesswoman of Brighton. She was the former owner of Arco Baleno, which was an amazing queer space in Kemptown. And she's the director of Bobu, which is an amazing app called Back Off, Back Up. And she talks about a loss of opportunity, and she talks about growing up in a, you know, Catholic Maltese environment. And, you know, being told that, you know, her investment in education and, you know, wasn't worth it because she would end up getting married and having children. And, you know, there were things that she wanted to do in her life that she didn't get to do because of those narratives. And for her, it was a real loss of opportunity. It was what could have been. And then obviously she talks about, you know, her sexuality and getting married and not living an authentic life for a period of time as well. So I think, you know, it's that human connection again, isn't it? It's like, we don't realize sometimes that we've lost something. We, you know, our circumstances, our life choices, or the life that we're set up around us, you know, sometimes they inform how things turn out for us. Mm-hmm. And we don't always get to do everything we want to do. So that's a loss. So I think people can just relate on a human level. It's about connection. It's about understanding that we all have different experiences, and also, even if we haven't had them yet, we may have them one day. So it's just interesting to inform yourself and educate yourself if you can, if that makes sense.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It absolutely does. Before we go, I would love to know a little bit about your writing life in Brighton. What's it like to be a writer here?
Well, you know, this is a really interesting question, because before I wrote this book, I didn't consider myself a writer. And I've actually been writing about this today, because now I do write a lot. Mm-hmm. But I never really, when I was growing up and I was thinking about writing, I wasn't thinking about writing. It wasn't something that was really, I thought, was in my path or something that I could do. I felt like to write or to be an author or to write books, you had to be super intelligent, or, you know, it only happened to a certain kind of person. You know, there was no visibility of that around me in my life kind of growing up. So it wasn't something I ever really thought about. And then as I start to get, you know, more in touch with my queerness and kind of my creativity and start my podcast, I realized that I had something to say and wanted to do that and wanted to be able to speak or write or contribute something towards the conversation. And then obviously once, you know, everything happened as it did and I had this idea, it was then the right time to really kind of start that. So I would say that, you know, part of that for me is living in Brighton. I've only been here 3 years, but I feel like since I moved here, there's just a creative energy which is inspiring. So many people are creating art, they're doing amazing things, and it's infectious. And I felt like when I came here and started my podcast, it was welcomed. People were excited about it. They were interested about it and wanted to be a part of it. And it's the same with the book, really. I felt like there was an energy around that. And, you know, why not have a go? Why don't you do this and, you know, say what you've got to say in this kind of form? So I just feel like it's been an amazing couple of years in terms of creativity, even though, you know, the book is born from something that was very painful. That's also been incredibly cathartic as well in that process. So I just feel like we're really lucky to live in such a creative city, and there's a real energy here. And I'm so excited that I've created this book at this point in my life and that it's happened here as well. And I'm very excited that there's a launch at Kemptown Bookshop on the 21st of May, which is the day of release. So I think Kathy and the team there are amazing, and I'm very much looking forward to having my launch there in Brighton. It's a real privilege.
Thank you so much, Andrew. You can pre-order Do You Believe in Life After Loss from all good bookshops, but do support independents, especially Kemptown Books, who are going to be hosting Andrew's launch. Andrew, how can we find and follow you?
So I'm on Instagram. My handle is at Fluey actually, if you like what I did there. And my website is www.flueyactually.com. And I've also got a podcast, which is Queer I Am the podcast. So lots of interesting conversations part of that. And that's also on Instagram. That's at Queer I Am the podcast.
It's the 1990s. Sarah is 15, obsessed with boy bands, sex, and getting drunk on Malibu. Most of all, she's hung up on her teacher, Mr. Keaveney. Fast forward 26 years, Sarah is 41, the last of the party girls, but the mad nights out are losing their shine, and her teenage dreams are now distant, queasy memories. There's only one thing for it, an adventure. So Sarah sets off with her sister Juliet on a whiskey-fueled camper van trip across Scotland. The sisters have never been alike, but they know all the dark corners of each other's history, and it's time to dig up some demons, kicking and screaming, because the things that wants to find us shouldn't define us forever, should they? Emma Jane Unsworth, welcome back and congratulations on the publication of Slags.
Thank you so much. It's so lovely to be here and chat with you again, Anna. Thanks for having me.
I absolutely raced through this book in 2 days, which is unheard of for me. I'm a slow reader, and just think it's an absolutely wonderful tour de force about love and sisterhood and aging and motherhood and non-motherhood and drinking and Scotland. When did this idea come to you?
Oh, well, thank you so much for reading it and for I'm so glad that you raced through it and that it was and that it was a pacey read. I think the idea originally came when I found some old diaries at my mum and dad's, because even though it's a pacey read and I'm so glad it is, it really has been a long time coming, this book. It's taken me 10 years to write. So it feels like it's you know, I don't think a book will ever take me this long to write again, and it's certainly no book before has taken this long. But I started writing it when I found some old teenage diaries at my parents' house up in North Manchester, and I found some diaries that I'd written when I was like 15 years old, and what surprised me about them was the confidence of my 15-year-old self in those pages. And I think I found them when I was sort of in my early 30s, and I had a lot of questions about what I was doing with my life, whether I was doing the right thing, the wrong thing, anything. And so I was there full of doubt, twice the age of this girl whose words I was reading in this book. And I was like, how is she so sorted out? And just that kind of that discrepancy shocked me and thrilled me and fascinated me and inspired me. And so I thought, I'm going to write about this, and I'm going to lift a lot of this verbatim, because it's just so, it's gold, kind of like those words that, and she was funny. And so I just took a lot of what she said, which, and I started to shape it into something that was like a story arc. I thought, okay, where that grew away from me, the real person. Because what happens to my teenage character Sarah in this book didn't happen to me. It's because, you know, it's even though everything I write comes from a seed of emotional truth, I'd say it's very rare that I'll write about anything that you know that would go into the realm of memoir or anything like that. So it grew away from her, and while it was doing that, I started to realize that I wanted an adult storyline on there as well. Because I thought, I asked myself the question, is this just a 15-year-old narrative? Is she just telling it, and does that make it YA, or is it still adult? It's like I had all these questions about what kind of book it was, where it was going. But actually, it soon became apparent that what I was interested in exploring was that disconnect between this person who's 15 and then who she might grow up into. And what her dreams might be, and her hopes might be, and her obsessions might be, and how they may or may not connect with the person she ends up being in 20 years. And that to me was so interesting because of the point in my life I was at. And then I started just building it out from there. And the adult storyline came. Now the adult storyline takes up half of the book. It's equally weighted, really. We alternate the chapters between the 1990s and between the present day. And that storyline came, the kind of the more delicate threads and nuances of that storyline came a lot later. And the sisters was something that I realized I wanted to explore as part of that adult storyline as well, because I always write about intense female relationships. They're what excite me and thrill me, and they're what I really want to dig into. And they're the things that I think give my life the most meaning, and that, but also have given me the biggest heartbreaks in my life as well, and the most intense sort of experiences, and just the grandest romances of my life, I think, have been my friendships. And so I always want to dig into friendship in some way, but often that does kind of like spill over into family stories as well. And so in adults, in my last book, I explored a mother-daughter relationship, which felt like an intense female relationship that I guess blurred the boundaries between family and friends and who you are when you grow up and if you can be friends as adults with your own mother. And then in this book, I just thought, yeah, it's a buddy story. It's a road trip. They have to be sisters on this, and they have to have this shared history. Who do you often have your strangest, deepest, darkest, twistiest history with? It's your sibling. Who has been there? Who is your greatest peer? It's your sibling. Who knows you inside out? And who might you have a different view of deep history to than, so, and your sibling, it seemed that just seemed to fit with so much of what I was writing. And so that inspired it as well. So my own teenage diaries, then sisters and intense female relationships, which is generally my jam.
Did you go on a road trip to research this? Because the stuff about camper vans feels like very, very real and well researched.
I did not need to research this novel because I have done that road trip. Well, I was going to say 100 times. That's an exaggeration. I've done it about 10 times. I have gone. My favorite thing to do is to get in a motorhome and go around the Highlands of Scotland. That is my happy place. It's my spiritual home. I love doing that. I've done so many over the years. I've been doing that since I was in my early 20s. I love the time alone, the solitude, the mountains, the peace. The idea that you've got like a desk on wheels and you can just kind of drive every day to somewhere new and do some writing is just like heaven. And I just love the little kind of like, just the little Wendy House aspect of a little camper van on the road. Maybe I was denied a Wendy House as a child and that's where this comes from. And I just always wanted to recreate it in like little camper vans where you get a little cupboard with all your little things to do your cooking. It's like that kind, that's, I just love that so much. And like cupboards to put all your clothes in. It's all very tidy and organized and like life in miniature. And I love that. And so I've done it many times. And so I didn't need to research this because I know it like the back of my hand. And it was such a pleasure to put it onto the page and to share my love of that trip. And that the A82, best road in the world. And just kind of like share my passion for that landscape and that kind of trip with readers.
Can we hear an extract, please?
With pleasure. So I'll just read from the beginning of the book. The title of the first chapter is Somewhere Near Watford. All the old party girls were falling. Sarah could feel it on the city streets, in the slow limp of Saturday nights, where no one went out anymore to pound the pavements with their passion or fury. Sofas were the new bar stools. People didn't salute the sun from jagged rooftops, glass in hand. People jogged instead at 5 a.m. Across the land, beds were made and slept in. Geese flew overhead unheard. The clubs and pubs were dying. Younger generations preferred coffee and conversation. Everyone was thinking about their gut health or their crochet or the state of the economy. Sarah herself, once a committed party girl, was regularly flirting with sobriety. This time she'd managed a month so far. She'd given up drinking in February, nothing so cliched as January, for God's sake, because she was starting to feel unwelcome in her own life. As though her personality was a badly fitting suit she'd inherited from a dead aunt. Night after night, she had sat sober in front of a candle, forgiving herself, waiting for clarity to hit. A month in, she was ready to cave. It was just so boring. Sarah possessed grit and tenacity like any woman with red hair, but the one thing she couldn't hack was boredom, which was why she was sneaking glances at someone else's phone, reading the texts of the woman sitting beside her. To be fair, they were excellent texts. Some of the best Sarah had ever read. They were a real treat. They were a sort of party. They had everything: intrigue, raunch, playfulness, and a plot twist. These are the texts. I keep thinking of you with Keely. I keep thinking of you coming over after and punishing me, tasting her on me. Have you got a lot on at work? Yeah, we're moving to a bigger office on a higher floor on Monday. These all sent in succession, barely a 30-second pause between, the shift in tone leaving its recipient seemingly unaffected. Sex and mundanity all wrapped up. Sarah was reeling, unsure whether this unflinching juxtaposition of opposites was evolved or basic. The woman whose phone she was spying on barely looked 30. She looked like she was coming home from a shift at a department store or a jewellery shop. She looked elegant but not rich, keen to shuck off her blouse and trousers and get into her pink onesie with a bowl of noodles. A normal life shot through with sexts. The train was heading out of London, bound for the north. Blocks of flats flicked past in her peripheral vision. The woman next to her skittered through her socials, checked her bank balance, ordered a pair of fur-lined Crocs. It wasn't the colour Sarah would have chosen, but this wasn't Sarah and it wasn't her life. Or her phone. She was just looking at it. It was Saturday night. This was entertainment. Ding! A new message arrived on the woman's phone, the alert blooming down blue from the top of the screen. The woman flicked back to her inbox. That'll be exciting for you and the team, XOXO. Sarah sighed. Can we get back to tasting Keely? It was a silent thought, but the woman seemed to sense it and self-consciously clicked her phone to sleep and placed it face down on the table, turning her head towards Sarah in an accusatory fashion. Sarah closed her eyes and pretended to be asleep. She could probably actually sleep, she was so tired. Should she do a little fake snore? No. It was hard to gauge the volume of such things, and overdoing it would incriminate her instantly. Instead, she resigned herself to a genuine, heartfelt slump. It was work, Sarah told herself. The lack of an exercise regime, too many decades of being a caner, but it was more than that too. She was suffering from a bone-deep exhaustion, sometimes so deep she struggled to get out of her chair. What was that? Was it the same thing the romantics called ennui or general malaise? Maybe it was just a social fantasy éclat. Sarah hoped she could give it a French name. Things with French names always sounded better. Like her sister. Sarah would be seeing Juliet the next day. They were going on a trip and needed to be on form. Holidays demanded that of you. Besides, Juliet would expect teetotal Sarah to be full of gusto, not dragging her anchor. Ding! The woman next to her turned her phone over. Sarah squinted and scried, trying to make out the words on the screen without moving her head. Maybe the texters would say goodbye to each other now. But how did you conclude a conversation like that? Did you go sexy or mundane to sign off? Going sexy might be too much of a leap after hugs and kisses and fur-lined Crocs. So then, back to work? Business as usual? Depressing. Because sex was important. In her teens, sex had been bravado and bluster, rarely about her own pleasure so much as the social conquest. In her 20s, sex was a power tool, a way to test her carnivorous desires to destroy men and eat their souls, which would have been fun if she hadn't secretly doubted her true attractiveness and found her carefully organised fantasies constantly punctured by the chaos and instability of reality. In her 30s, sex was rife with fertility considerations. Was she? Did she want to be? Could she? Was it too early, too late? The viral questioning of that exhausting epoch. In her early 40s so far, she was feeling a desirous ownership of her body, seeping back under her bedroom door at night like light from an old lamp. This was her decade to really take it all back, to sharply skewer everything she wanted before the following decade's menopause sent her into another chapter of manufactured spite, telling her she was a washed-up crone, soon to be invisible. Her vision was soon unfogged by capitalism's weakening of womanhood, and she wanted to snatch the window while it lasted. Sarah didn't know how she felt about her ovaries, but she was definitely looking forward to not having to worry all the time about how she was supposed to feel about her ovaries.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be dropped back into Sarah's world. I fell in love with her as a character. And I think one thing that you do with all your books, actually, is this really great job of showing women in their multitudes and in their mess. Is that something that's really important to you as a writer?
Yeah, totally, totally. And, you know, to me, they're just normal. To me, I mean, I think the multitudes is right. I think that it's that just to kind of break out of the expectations of what you're meant to be at a certain age. That's always been something, maybe because I've done things that are kind of, in inverted commas, late, like considerably for my life. Each stage, I've always kind of, you know, didn't have kids until I was nearly 40. And I think I've always felt and hated those pressures, those social pressures to do and be a certain thing at a certain age, and really wanted to write about them as a way of trying to crack them open and also just share different options and different narratives with women, with readers, so that there wasn't just the same old happy ending to a romance. You know, a romance could be about finding a new way of being in love with yourself and you know, or just kind of not being in love with anything and having a break from that and just kind of having an alternative, I think, because I just got, when I started writing, when I wrote my first book, Animals, that was, I really felt as though I wanted to. I couldn't find a tonally a spiky rom-com that didn't end with the boy and the girl getting together. And I was just sick of reading that story. I wanted to write something different. So that's what I really tried to do, and that's what I think I'm still trying to do.
Another thing I think you do in the book is you depict the sexuality and the sexual verve of teenage girls really well and really unflinchingly. You spoke about how you kind of got a lot of the young Sarah's voice from your teenage diaries, but how did you find writing this?
Found it really uncomfortable a lot of the time. Really funny though, to really trusting that teenage voice felt risky because I'm not a teenager, obviously, far from it. But I did feel like I was channeling her as faithfully as I could, that character. And so she did have a very loud voice in my head when I was writing her sections, and it's such a tricky one. And the conundrum that kind of occurred to me as I was writing is that really what feminism isn't really serving women at either end of the age spectrum. I mean, there's lots of people it's not serving, but I think there's an either end of the age spectrum that I really felt was being severely underserved. And I think that teenage, very very young women are just not. They're not given enough power, and yet it's such a strange age. You feel so vital, and you feel so full of kind of you're full of these hormones, and you're full of these burgeoning desires, and this, and you're full of all these ideas, and you really want to have a sense of autonomy and agency in the world, and you deserve that. So but at the same time, you're so vulnerable as well. I think at that age, and teenagers can be so vulnerable. It's such a strange age. And the conundrum is how to empower and protect young teenage girls at the same time. How do you do that? And the best way I thought of as a writer was to give her a voice that she could that felt like it was her speaking, and from inspired by my own 15-year-old voice that was the kind of like the original seed of it. And so that felt like the sort of the best that I could do, and I really wanted to stay true to that, but it wasn't always comfortable, and the book isn't comfortable. But I'm not a writer who always writes in the comfort zones, and even my own, never mind anyone who might be reading it. But and that's what I find exciting. It's the grey areas that really interest me as a novelist. It's the areas where there might not be an answer, and I'm not sure novels should give answers. I think they should just explode open lots of questions, and that's what I look for as a reader. And I think that, and I hope that's what I hope I just explode lots of things open when I'm writing books.
I think you definitely do. As I said, I absolutely loved Slags, which is out now with the Borough Press, an imprint of HarperCollins. What's next for you, Emma?
So I'm writing a new novel that is about two women in their 40s who fell out in their 20s and then are forced to be friends again because of life circumstances. They're forced to be friends again in their 40s, or they're forced to be in each other's orbits again. The question is whether they'll be able to be friends again. So that's what I'm writing, because I'm really interested in friendship breakups and what you do with your big friendship ex if you ever encounter them again. So that's what I'm writing about novel wise, and I'm really enjoying that. And then I'm writing lots of television, which is lots of fun. I'm got a show that we're going to be shooting next year, and then got lots of things in development. And then I'm working on a couple of films. I'm working on a musical, lots and lots and lots of things, but that's the way my brain works. I like to have lots of things on the go. That gives me my focus and momentum, even though that sounds like it would give you the opposite. It's a kind of organized chaos up in there, promise. At least, yeah, I think so.
Thank you so much for joining us, Emma.
Thank you so much for having me. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
Beyond the Book Festival is back this year and will run on the 10th of May from 9:30 until 6 at the Friends Meeting House in Central Brighton. Very excitingly, this year it is part of Brighton Fringe, and Phil Viner joins me from Beyond the Book to tell us more about it. Phil, welcome back.
Thanks, Anna. It's lovely to see you again.
So let's talk about Beyond the Book Festival. First, can you just tell us a bit about the festival, how it started and how it's developed?
So it started last year, and it's organised by six Brighton writers. So David Fennell is a brilliant crime writer. He is the festival director. We've got Araminta Hall, who is amazing, and her new Apple TV show is shooting at the moment, which is really exciting. We have got Steve Watson, S.J. Watson, who wrote the biggest book of the last 20 years, Before I Go to Sleep. And we've got the amazing Erin Young, who writes crime, but is also, as Robin Young, one of the biggest historical novelists of the last 10 years, and ex-chief superintendent Graham Bartlett, so who's now a brilliant crime writer. So basically, and me, I'm the lowest on the totem pole. And we come together and organise what is a multi-genre festival. So we have crime, we have true crime, we've got sci-fi and fantasy for the first time that I'm really excited about, and historical. It's going to be absolutely fantastic. And key Brighton writers again, so Dorothy Coomson, Eddie Griffiths, Ruth Ware, three of the biggest names in writing. It really is going to be a good day.
So can you run us through the lineup of the day, please?
So we're starting with Dorothy. Now, what's really interesting is it's not just Dorothy, but her agent is coming in, her editor and her publicist. And we're going to look at all of the stages that go to make a bestseller. And the wonderful local thriller writer, Joe Furness, is going to be grilling them. But it's the kind of background to how the industry works that you wouldn't normally get. So that's amazing. our headliners are Ruth Ware and Ellie Griffiths, two of the world's biggest crime writers, and they're being grilled by William Shaw, again, local writer, brilliant crime writer and journalist. The one I'm really excited about, most of all, is Hallie Rubenholder's coming in, and she has written Story of a Murder. Her previous book was The Untold Stories of the Victims of Jack the Ripper, so it's true crime, but this one is about Crippen, and he was a wife poisoner, and but the police said, oh, he's a doctor, he can't be guilty of anything. But a group of Edwardian women worked out what he was doing and hounded him and hounded him and hounded him. And even though the police wouldn't believe him, they forced him to run, and then the police went after him. It's a fascinating story. And in historical, we've got Laura Shepherd Robinson, who is brilliant, whose new book, The Art of a Lie, is about to come out, and she's going to be talking about the Square of Sevens. We've got the head of the Historical Writers Association, Imogen Robertson, brilliant. We've got the amazing Nikki May, who rewrote Mansfield Park for a modern age, brilliant. And Eleni Kyriakou, whose new book, A Beautiful Way to Die, is set in 50s Hollywood, and it is about the casting couch in the 50s. Brilliant. And then we've got the sci-fi people. So Natasha Pulley, who is this brilliant writer who reimagines Greek mythology. We've got Dancers of the Dawn writer Zuleika Afzal, who has these amazing, like, desert assassins, all women who dance their magic into the world. We've got Adam Simcox, The Dying Squad, brilliant, and moderated by Mark Stay, who is a broadcaster, screenwriter, and writes these incredible witchcraft books called The Witches of Woodford. I mean, it is going to be such a good day. There are small groups, so 16 writers have been selected to pitch to agents, and there will be an announcement of the winner of that competition, and maybe that could be life-changing for somebody. Ex-chief superintendent Graham Bartlett and TM Payne, who both ex-coppers, are going to be arresting members of the audience and processing them. You can volunteer for that, it's going to be really good fun. And at the end, so we finish at 5, but between 6 and 8, there is an after party across the street at Goldsboro Books. Anybody that buys a ticket, come drink a glass of wine, schmooze with the writers, meet the agents, just really get into the literary groove in Brighton, because we are so lucky. Brighton is absolutely amazingly packed, jam full. You can't throw a stone without hitting a writer, and some really fantastic writers. So I'm not saying throw stones at writers, I would never say that, couple, maybe, but no. But come along to Beyond the Book. It is going to be the most wonderful day of literary feasts and wine afterwards. What more could you want?
Bill, that was one of the most compelling pitches of anything I've ever heard. So if you are able to, I highly recommend that you go to Beyond the Book Festival. You can get tickets at beyondthebook.com, and I will also pop a ticket link in our bio on Instagram. Thanks so much for joining us, Bill.
It's actually beyondthebookfestival.org for us, or brightonfringe.org for tickets. So please, please come and spend some lovely time with us.
How great was that pitch from Phil? I tell you what, I will see you at Beyond the Book Festival. It sounds absolutely wonderful. I had such a good time speaking to all of our guests today and hope you enjoyed it too. You can follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club, where we will have links to everything we've spoken about today. If you've got an idea for the show, we are actively booking guests, and you can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com with your pitches. We will be back next month.